Flora Luckman is here with our video pick of the week. Hi, Flora. What have you got for us today?
Ira, today we have the story of a comet that has a tale to tell.
Comets are...
Get it?
I get it. It's great fun.
It's even better, Ira, because actually the part of what the comet is telling us comes from its tail. Okay, so let me step
go
back.
For it.
Okay,
go for it.
I'll just one-man band here. Okay, back in 2011, a comet called Lovejoy, Comet Lovejoy, grazed the sun, went through the sun's corona. And space geeks probably already know this because it happened in 2011. But the neat thing was that it was imaged from all these different angles. And what researchers like Cooper Downs, who's an astrophysicist at Predictive Science in San Diego, California, saw was that this comet, when it passed through the sun, which it's really hot, right? So most comets don't even make it through. And this comet lived to tell the tale. Anyway, it did this wiggle. The tail wiggled behind it. And what they were reporting on this week in Science is sort of trying to explain that wiggle, tie that wiggle to the sun's dynamics.
This is Science Friday from NPR. I'm Ira Flatow here with Flora Luckman, our video pick of the week. And in the video, you can actually see the wiggle of the tail as it goes through the sun's corona. Right?
You can.
It's just amazing.
I love the SDO. This is the observatory from NASA that's doing a lot of this imaging. The video is just beautiful, and you can, yeah, you can actually see this little wiggle. And what's happening is that the charged particles from the comet are getting moved around by the sun's magnetic field, sort of like iron filings near a magnet, really. And what this allows people like Cooper Downs to do is check their models of the sun's magnetic field against observational data of the field. And, of course, this is of interest to even us Earthlings because solar weather, you know, what the sun sends towards us and can interfere with electrical grids, is all part of this process. So so that's sort of the idea behind this week's paper. But you can see it for yourself on our website.
And it's up there on our website at sciencefriday.com, augmented, of course, by Flora's original and unique animation on the videos, which
and
is
rudimentary.
It's beautiful. It's beautiful. What's interesting also that you mention about what you mentioned in the video is how much luck played into this discovery, right?
That's right. You can't send spacecraft there because the weather's really bad on the sun. As you might imagine, it's a little
bit hot.
So you have to wait for these celestial explorers, as Cooper Downs calls them, to just happen to go by. And you get the sense, I get the sense from him, there's a more than a little bit of personification going on, which, of course, I amplify in the video because why not? But let me just give you a sense of how he describes them.
These comets are, in a sense, sacrificing themselves and providing us with a rich amount of information. The fact that we name comets after the discoverer, or at least the large comets, really does add this human element to these celestial objects. But after I've been staring at this data for almost a year, I certainly feel a personal attachment to it.
That's Cooper Downs from Predictive Science in San Diego.
Yeah, he's very proud of his work, it looks like.
Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, so I asked this about luck, too, and he said, yes, well, we have to take what we can get. But it turns out that Comet Ison is headed towards the sun in November. So they're hoping for another batch of data coming up this fall, something to keep an eye out for, he said, because it's going to look really cool, too,
that's,
even for us.
For us, that's supposed to be a super comet you'll be able to see with the naked eye up in the sky.
Yeah.
So So this comet actually was not gobbled up by the sun. It made its journey and it went back out again.
It went back out. It did break up a little bit later.
Oh, yeah?
It lived to tell the tale for just a little bit amount of time. But that was a history maker. I don't think we've ever seen a comet do that before. So even though it survived only for a few days, it did survive.
If you want to see what a tail of a comet looks like, it's almost like lightning strikes. You know, it's like lightning bolts? Lightning bolts as it goes by around the sun that makes its pass, and its tail wiggles in the magnetic field. It's kind of, really kind of neat.
The sun imagery is really, it's worth looking at. It's really cool.
Yeah, the sun stuff is terrific. Go to our website at sciencefriday.com. It's our video pick of the week up there on the website. It'll also be available, you know, if you want to download it and look on it with your web browser or on your app on your iPhone or Android app. Thank you, Flora.
Thanks, Ira.
Just a quick reminder, if you're going to be in the Seattle area, come and see us. We're going to be at the Pacific Science Center a week from today. We'll be there. Yeah, you can sit in the audience. If you want to know more information about how to do that, go to our website, sciencefriday.com/Pacific. Greg Smith composed our theme music. We had help today from NPR librarian Kim Oleski. And as I say, go to our website to see Flora's video pick and all the other video picks we have up there. And we'll see you next week in Seattle. I'm Ira Flatow in New York. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. When you think wine, one of the countries most closely associated with winemaking is France, right? Of course. But the French didn't always know how to make wine. Thousands of years ago, they'd probably had been drinking a mixed fermented beverage made from fruit, grain, and honey. But writing in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, researchers report that they have been able to trace back the origins of viniculture in France to about 500 BC using a combination of archaeological detective work and biomolecular approaches in the lab. And one of the men who's been studying the origins of winemaking for many years, the man some people call the Indiana Jones of wine, is Patrick McGovern, scientific director of the Biomolecular Archaeology Laboratory at the University of Pennsylvania Museum of Archaeology and Anthropology in Philadelphia. He's authored many books, including Ancient Wine, The Search for the Origins of Viniculture, Uncorking the Past, The Quest for Wine, Beer, and Other Alcoholic Beverages. He joins us this week. Welcome.
Hello, Ira. Nice to talk to you.
Why do they call you the Indiana Jones?
Well, because I've gone out around the world, you know, doing different archaeological investigations, which have turned up some pretty unusual fermented beverages,
Like what?
Well, one of the first that we did was a tomb that the University of Pennsylvania Museum excavated in central Turkey, which is believed to be either the tomb of Midas or his father, Gordias, west of Ankara. And it was done by the museum back in 1957 and had one of the largest Iron Age drinking sets in it that the excavators had the foresight to bring the residues in the drinking set back here to Philadelphia. And it was one of the easiest excavations I was ever on. I just had to walk up two flights of stairs, gather up the residues, and then we started doing our analysis.
So you take the dregs, so to speak, out of the amphora jugs, and you bring
right.
it back to the lab? And
it's the evaporated remains or residues of the original beverage that was in the vessels. And in this case, it turned out to be a combination of barley, honey, and grapes. So it was like a wine, beer, and mead all in one. And, you know, your stomach might cringe a little bit at the thought of such a beverage, especially back in 2000 when people weren't doing all the experimental work that mm-hmm. we have going on today, especially among craft brewers. So we did some experimental archaeology and got a bunch of microbrewers to go back to their breweries and do up, you know, different versions of what we later called Midas Touch.
And so you can still make that old stuff today.
Well, yeah, it's, yeah. Still, it's out there. It's available. So it's produced by Dogfish Head Brewery. They're the ones that won the competition.
Uh-huh. Well, let's talk about this French discovery.
Sure.
Tell us about what you found.
Okay, well, this is a site in southern France called Lot today, or Lotera in antiquity, very close to Montpellier. And it had a merchant's quarter near the harbor in which there were amphoras, you know, large jars that are used in shipping various goods around the Mediterranean that were in the merchant's room. And we also had a what turned out to be a wine press very close by. So these amphoras were from central Italy, from the Etruscan area, dating around 500 BC, as you said. And we applied a whole series of analytical techniques to figure out what the contents of those vessels were. And it turned out to be a very interesting wine that had pine resin added to it, also rosemary, perhaps basil. So it wasn't just sort of your typical French wine you pick up today.
Yeah, and do you believe this to be the oldest remnant of French viticulture?
Well, we believe that the wine press nearby, this is our early, once they build up an interest among the southern French, at that time it would have been the Celts or the Gauls, once they got interested in wine, then the logical next step is to set up your own winemaking facility. And so this is where the press comes into the picture. It is the earliest wine press that has so far been found in France. Now, that's not to say that there won't be other discoveries, you know, at sites nearby. Like Marseille had a Greek colony, for instance. But this one at Latera is the earliest native Celtic wine press that has so far been discovered.
And how do you think it made its journey, the winemaking, to France from other countries?
Well, it first, you know, was amphoras of wine coming in from the Etruscan area. Mm-hmm. The wine press is made out of local limestone. So that indicates that they are, you know, setting up their industry right from the materials that they have at hand. They probably need some help from the Etruscans to lay out the vineyards. They have to have the grapevine, the domesticated grapevine that was ultimately domesticated in the Near East. That has to be transplanted probably from central Italy over to southern France. And then the southern French have to be tutored at first in how to lay out the vineyards and how to make the wine.
How do you get this? So they're bringing the rootstock, the living vines with them in a boat?
That's what we think. I mean, we have examples where grapevines are found in moist soil in the hull of the ship. And that would be probably the way it was done.
So the rootstocks that people today associated with French wines came from another country?
One part of the genetic signature is of the domesticated grape. And then as the domesticated grape travels across the Mediterranean, you get crosses with wild grapes because the wild Eurasian grape, Vitis vinifera, it grows all along the southern coast or along the Mediterranean. So as you bring in the domesticated grapevine, you know, starting over in, you know, the area of Lebanon today, and you move across to Crete and Greece and then on to Italy, you're getting crosses between that domesticated vine and the wild grapes that are growing there. Mm-hmm. And so you get a whole series of cultivars springing up. And those are the ones that then, you know, get chosen for different reasons. It could be the color of the grape. It could be the thinness of the skin, the sugar, flavor, and so forth. But the grapevine is very promiscuous, so it crosses quite easily.
Can you tell from the residue whether the wine was red or white that was in there?
Well, we saw a sort of a reddish hint, you know, which suggested a red wine. But if we base our thinking a little bit more on what the Romans do later, white wines became the most popular wines, and that may be because it's a rare mutation in nature to go to the white or the albino type of grape. There's only like 5 or 6% of the grapes that will switch over. So that becomes more desirous and you know, has higher social value, you could say, among the upper class, to you know, be drinking a very refined white wine.
Were people drinking beer before they were drinking wine?
Yes, that's been documented not in southern France yet, but up into Germany and Scandinavia and Scotland, where it's all across Europe and the Celtic areas, they were doing mixed or hybrid beverages in which, just like I mentioned, the Midas touch. I mean, they put together, you know, high sugar fruit, very high concentrated sugar honey, and different herbs from the areas in which they're in. So, for instance, we just came back from Sweden where we did a Nordic grog, you could call it, in which it has lingonberry, bog cranberry, honey, and wheat and barley. And then the herbs include bog myrtle, yarrow, meadow sweet, and we also put in birch resin because we have chemical analyses of samples in tombs in Scandinavia, and it's also been tested in Scotland and Germany, of such a beverage.
What would be, and forgive the pun, what would be the holy grail for an Indiana Jones like you? What would be the ultimate?
Well, that would be to go right back to the beginning, you know, to do like a dino brew, you know, sort of a Garden of Eden type of beverage, I guess. And, you know, unfortunately, in the Paleolithic period, the containers get destroyed. They're probably made out of leather, wood, or whatever. So we don't have remnants of any containers from the Paleolithic period. And that's important because once you have a container like pottery, made of pottery, the liquids get absorbed into that, and it helps to retain the ancient organic materials until the biomolecular archaeologist like us comes along thousands of years later.
Do you have any bets of where the cradle of civilization for wine and beer originate?
Well, I would say it goes right back to the beginning of the human species, so Africa.
Yeah, that far back?
Yeah, I mean, because they were probably chewing all different kinds of grains and roots, sorghum, millet, bulrush. And we have enzymes that break down the starches into sugar and can be fermented, you know, into fermented beverage. They certainly knew about honey, which is the most concentrated source of sugar and ferments quite easily.
Was the aim to make alcohol or to store
for preservation, of course, and special flavors that fermentation gives and aromas. But I think the main incentive is the mind-altering effect, because that is where you get the pleasure cascade of neurotransmitters occurring when you drink an alcoholic beverage. And it explains, I think, why beer in particular, beers, I should say, in plural, is sort of the center of all the different cultures, the many, many cultures in Africa, where often they'll put the brewery right at the center of the village and all the ceremonies revolving around the ancestors, which is primary to a lot of the peoples there. Includes a fermented beverage that they pour onto the grave of the ancestor.
One more question. As a chemist, what do you want to know? What tool would you like to have or know? What thing would you like to know now that you don't?
Well, we've gotten a lot of good tools recently. I mean, the one we used in this paper, which is a liquid chromatography mass spectrometry with an Orbitrap detector, I mean, that goes down to parts per billion for a lot of the compounds that we're looking for. You know, ultimately, I don't know, there's like alcoholic clouds in the star-forming regions in the middle of the Milky Way. Maybe get some sort of a real time machine out there and explore
that,
too.
I should need a flux capacitor. That's all you're missing from you.
Yes.
Thank you. We don't have one here, so we can't give it to
you. Well, you'll still have to come up with that.
All right.
And just let us know. You know, we're ready to do it.
All right, Dr. McGovern, thank you very much. Patrick
McGovern, nice talking to you.
You too. Senior is Scientific Director of the Biomolecular Archaeology Laboratory. That's at the University of Pennsylvania Museum of Archaeology and Anthropology in Philadelphia. We're going to take a break, switch gears, and talk about what happens if the big one, the really big one, hits us. We'll come back and talk about scatter, adapt, and remember how humans will survive a mass extinction. We want to hear what you have to say, how to do it. So stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from NPR.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Audie Cornish. This week, President Obama called on Congress to make life harder for companies called patent assertion entities. Many in Silicon Valley call them patent trolls. These companies don't make anything. They buy up patents and use them to sue people who do make things. Last year, about 60% of all patent lawsuits were brought by these so-called trolls. 2 years ago, NPR's Laura Seidel and Planet Money's Alex Bloomberg investigated a company called Intellectual Ventures that some say is the biggest patent troll of them all. They recently revisited the story and discovered it had taken some surprising twists.
Back in 2011, I put the question of whether or not Intellectual Ventures is a patent troll to its co-founder, Nathan Myhrvold.
Are you a patent troll?
Well, that's a term that has been used by people to mean someone they don't like who has patents.
Intellectual ventures, says Myhrvold, is anything but. He says it's in the business of promoting innovation, supporting inventors who hold patents but can't make money off of them because companies are stealing their ideas.
That's where intellectual ventures comes in. Intellectual ventures buys their patents and licenses them out to companies that make stuff. 2 years ago, when we first visited Intellectual Ventures, they gave us an example of an inventor they'd helped, a guy named Chris Crawford. Joe Chernesky, a vice president at Intellectual Ventures, is one of two people who mentioned Crawford.
The neat thing about Chris is he had no idea how to get money for his patents. He eventually found Intellectual Ventures, so we bought those patents.
So I figured I want to talk to this guy. Not so simple. It turned out that trying to talk to Chris Crawford took us on a multi-year odyssey where things didn't exactly fit the story that Intellectual Ventures was telling us. It started when I called Intellectual Ventures to get Chris Crawford's contact info. I got a strange email back in response. I was told they no longer own Chris Crawford's patent.
We did eventually locate Crawford on our own, but he never responded to our many emails and phone calls. He had four patents, all pretty similar, and we focused on one of them, patent 577-1354. He got it in 1998, back in the relatively early days of the internet.
The patent says this invention makes it possible to connect to an online service provider to do a bunch of stuff, software purchases, online rentals, data backups. The patent makes it seem like this one guy, Chris Crawford, invented a lot of what we do on the internet every day. We weren't sure what to make of this, so we turned to an expert.
Rick McLeod is a patent lawyer and former software engineer who we asked to evaluate Chris Crawford's patent. So he went on a search to see if anyone else in the field was already doing the thing Chris Crawford claimed to invent in 1993 when he first filed his patent.
There were institutions, both academic and businesses, that used computers in this way. And I think it's a very interesting collection of things that were well known in the 1980s.
In patent language, there's lots of prior art.
None of this was actually new.
Do you think this patent should have been issued in the first place?
No, I don't.
People in Silicon Valley will tell you that the problem with software patents today is that all kinds of things are getting patented that aren't breakthroughs and don't deserve a patent. They're too broad or too obvious.
And the problem with broad, obvious patents is that it's easy to use them in the way we discovered Chris Crawford's patents were being used, to sue people for patent infringement.
After Intellectual Ventures sold Crawford's patent, it ended up in the hands of a company named Oasis Research. Less than a month after getting these patents, Oasis Research started suing people.
There was hardly any public information about Oasis Research. One of the few details that was available, an address in Marshall, Texas, 104 East Houston Street, Suite 190.
Right now, we're going into the first floor of the Baxter Building, which is 104 East Houston.
This is Michael Smith. He's an attorney in Marshall, Texas, who does mostly patent cases. He agreed to show us the offices of Oasis Research. They're in a nondescript two-story building on the town's main square, two doors down from the federal courthouse.
And here we go, Suite 190, Oasis Research, LLC.
It was late morning on a weekday, not a holiday, but the door was locked. Through the crack underneath, you could see there were no lights on inside. Marshall is a very small town, 24,000 people. Michael was born and raised here, so we started quizzing him about Oasis.
Does it have any employees that you know about?
Not that I know of.
Have you ever seen any people coming in and out of that office?
No, I haven't.
If you don't mind, I'm going to knock on the door and just see if there's anyone here today.
I know this is kind of cliche at this point, knocking on the door of the suspected fake office.
Nothing.
But we'd flown a long way. According to information the Obama administration released this week, there are thousands of companies like Oasis Research out there. Companies that don't seem to make anything or have any employees, whose only business seems to be suing other companies for patent infringement.
We'd come to Marshall to figure out which story about Intellectual Ventures was true. Was it a patent troll or a protector of struggling inventors? 2 years ago, this empty office was where the hunt for information about Chris Crawford and Intellectual Ventures ended.
But in the intervening 2 years, the lawsuit that Oasis was filing at the time has now concluded. And because of information that came out at trial, we can now answer a lot of the questions we couldn't back then.
Of the 18 companies that Oasis originally sued, 16 settled. Only two went all the way to trial, EMC and Carbonite. Full disclosure, Carbonite is an underwriter of NPR news programs.
Lawyers for the two companies dug into Chris Crawford's history, looking for clues that might invalidate his patent. Clues, for example, that he had not told the truth when he first filed it.
One of the first places they went looking was the company where he was working at the time he claimed to have come up with his idea. Here's Carbonite's chief counsel, Danielle Scheer.
We located some individuals who had worked with Chris Crawford in the early 1990s.
Specifically, Crawford's boss, who told the lawyers, yes, I was with Crawford when those ideas and the patents were developed. And they weren't only Chris Crawford's ideas. The idea for a remote online backup system mainly came from two other guys, Jack Bird and Don Atwood. They'd come up with the idea to solve a problem that they themselves were having.
This was in 1990. Don Atwood and Jack Bird are business partners.
They had a technology consulting company, and they were backing up all their important files on floppy disks. They thought, there's got to be a better way. How about backing up our data remotely over the phone line using a modem? We should start a company that does that.
And this, finally, is where Chris Crawford enters the picture. He was invited to be part of the small group trying to get this backup company off the ground. There were four people involved. Crawford was the last one added.
They met regularly on Saturdays at Jack Bird's apartment, but they never figured out a way to get consumer online backup working using the technology available in the early 90s, phone lines and modems, so they disbanded the company.
But all those meetings where they'd been figuring out how this backup system would work, Chris Crawford had been the main note taker.
A couple years later, Chris Crawford, he ends up filing some patents, and he uses the documents that he's created in these meetings to prove that he has this idea for the patent and to come up with the claims.
His three former business partners have no idea Crawford is doing this. And once he gets his patents, he doesn't start a business of his own. He sells the patents to Intellectual Ventures for $12 million, plus a cut of all future proceeds.
The problem was that Chris Crawford had sold a patent for $12 million that did not give credit to the other inventors. If Chris Crawford's three former business partners had also developed the idea, they too should have been listed as co-inventors on the original patent applications.
But how to prove this to a jury?
In the thousands of pages that Chris Crawford submitted to the patent office in order to obtain his patents, one of the documents had a sentence that said that this is in response to Jack Bird's idea to provide online backup. And, of course, one of the excellent attorneys that worked on this for EMC and Carbonite located that document and questioned Chris about it.
The May 23, 1992 proposal, which is marked as Exhibit 10.
Yes, I'm looking at it.
All right.
And here he is, the man we've been looking for, Chris Crawford. This is sound from a videotaped deposition he gave as part of the Oasis trial. He's polished, crisp white shirt, tan, tortoiseshell reading glasses.
And he offers a rather surprising explanation for how the sentence saying that this business was, quote, Jack Bird's idea, doesn't actually mean that the business was Jack Bird's idea. His explanation? He was using the apostrophe S incorrectly. The lawyer asks him to clarify.
You certainly know what the use of an apostrophe S means, do you not?
I have to say that my grammar is not strong enough to tell you right now with clarity when an apostrophe S is used.
This explanation apparently did not convince the jury, and Oasis lost the case. But for the 16 companies who settled, it's probably too late. Legally, it'll be tough to get their money back.
A spokesperson for one of those companies wrote in an email, quote, "We were hit hard by this lawsuit. Infringement on our part seemed completely bogus, but we could not afford to fight it. Even with the settlement, we were forced to lay off employees. We are still paying out on the settlement agreement."
The Oasis case gives us a unique glimpse into the normally hidden economics of patent lawsuits. Usually in these cases, everyone settles and signs a non-disclosure agreement. But because Carbonite won at trial, they were happy to reveal how much money Oasis wanted from them.
Carbonite's chief counsel, Danielle Scheer.
Well, the original number that was thrown out, I don't think it was official, was they wanted $20 million.
Based on this number, one expert we talked to thought Oasis might have brought in as much as $100 million suing people with Chris Crawford's patents.
$100 million. And who got that money? Well, according to documents filed with the court in Texas, 90% of the net profits went to Intellectual Ventures. 90% of potentially tens of millions of dollars. Intellectual Ventures declined our request to comment on this number.
Chris Crawford didn't make out too badly either. The documents also say that Chris Crawford gets 17.5% of the money that Intellectual Ventures makes. Chris Crawford did not respond to repeated requests to comment for this story.
Because of the money you can make, lots of people are entering the patent assertion business. According to figures the president released this week, the number of patent assertion entity lawsuits in 2012 was nearly double what it was just a year earlier in 2011.
But as suits like this increase, more and more people and business interests want change. The tech industry, the supermarket industry, the Consumer Electronics Association, Google, and now the President of the United States. I'm Laura Seidel.
And I'm Alex Blumberg for NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Audie Cornish. Say the name Judy Blume to almost any woman under a certain age, and you'll probably get this reaction. Her face lights up. She's transported back to her childhood self, curling up with books she knows will speak directly to her. To her anxiety about relationships, romantic ones, yes, but also with siblings and parents. For a new generation of girls, Blume has entered a new medium. Believe it or not, none of her books has been made into a feature film until now, with the release of Tiger Eyes. Just like in the 1981 novel, our heroine Davy deals with a lot more than just boy trouble. Her dad is shot and killed while minding his convenience store in Atlantic City.
I miss him. I miss him so much.
I know. So do I.
What are we gonna do, Mom?
I'm going to figure that out.
The film follows Davy and her family as they figure it out. And as Judy Blume told us, the making of the movie version Tiger Eyes was a family affair. She adapted it with her son.
My son, Larry, you know, has always wanted to make this into a movie since he was 18, and it's taken 30 years, I think. And I have passion to do it, too, because we were going to work on it together.
And I heard that it was actually difficult to get it made, though.
It wasn't difficult to get it made. Someone came to us with a budget. It wasn't a large budget, but it was enough to make this film. And that was not the difficult part. The difficult part was finding a distributor who saw something in it and believed in it.
Because it doesn't quite fit the modern Harry Potter, Hunger Games, Twilight,
well, no, it doesn't.
Young adults,
it doesn't, does
world.
It? Yeah, it's real life. But it's funny because the distributors said, well, we don't know how to market this. Do we market it to teenage girls? That's one way of marketing it. Or do we market it to your nostalgia readers? And we can't do both. And I said, but that's the only way to do it because I couldn't pick one audience over the other.
And your son, Lawrence Blume, he said that what shocked me was that a big segment of the business knew who Judy Blume was but didn't understand who she was. And part of it is that the film business is run mostly by old white men, he says, and some young ones too, who didn't grow up with her books.
I think he would take that back now. That I don't think he would take back the fact that I had all these wonderful fans out there that maybe the people in the suits didn't understand. Larry made a fabulous little video for them called Who is Judy Blume? And it's so funny. It's people, you know, saying, who is Judy Blume? And they tell their story about reading me, whether it's Whoopi Goldberg or Joan Rivers or Chelsea Handler, who owes me big time for the title of her book. Are you there, Vodka? It's me, Chelsea.
Right.
I mean, it's just a wonderful tape that I said to Larry, save that and show it at my memorial service because it will make everyone laugh.
Now, your son is the director, and it's interesting because the story Tiger Eyes actually mimics your lives in a way, right? At one point, you uprooted your family and went to New Mexico.
We did, although when I was writing the book, it had nothing to do with that. And it's so interesting to see the movie now, and I feel so differently. Was I, you know, when you're writing, you really don't know where your ideas are coming from. I was a girl who lost her beloved father suddenly. He wasn't shot and killed. He died of a heart attack. I was with him at the time. My mother lived 30 years after that and was never able to talk about that day. I learned very quickly that I couldn't say anything about it because it would just be so hard for her. My father was the parent who could talk to me or wanted to talk to me. Let's put it that way. You know, kids don't always make it easy. I mean, the parent can say, I'm here for you if ever you want to talk about that. But the child doesn't always take them up on it.
And your books do a good job of sort of showing both sides of that, even though it's from the point of view of the kid, you get that they're an unreliable narrator in a way. And you were writing these as a parent, right? I mean, did this kind of affect the way you thought about your kids?
Well, I wish I could tell you that it all made me a better parent. I think that all those kids who grew up on my books think that I must have been the world's greatest parent. And of course, I wasn't. I was as imperfect as any parent. And you get older and you look back and you see the mistakes that you made, and there's nothing that you can do except sometimes say to your kid, I'm really sorry about that. But you have to move on. And I think we have to forgive ourselves for the mistakes we make too, the mistakes that we make with our kids.
Well, Judy Blum, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
The movie based on Judy Blum's novel, Tiger Eyes, opens today in select theaters. It's also available on demand. Now, before we let Judy Blum go, I had to ask her, can she just tell what kind of person someone is by which of her books they say is their absolute favorite? Not surprisingly, she had a story to share.
The UPS guy who once came to my apartment and said, Oh, are you that, Judy Blum? I love your books. I knew what he was going to say. Fudge. I knew that he had grown up with fudge. But guys surprise me all the time, telling me that they read the, quote, girl books.
And while we're talking about books for young listeners, we want to remind you about our latest pick for NPR's Backseat Book Club. It's called The One and Only Ivan by Catherine Applegate. It's the story of a gorilla living in a mall who tries to save a young elephant from a similar fate. We want questions for the author from young readers, age 9 to 14. So you can send them to backseatbookclub@npr.org or tweet your questions to NPR Backseat.
This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Celeste Headlee. Michelle Martin is away. Coming up, we speak with a Pulitzer Prize-winning photographer who just lost his job after 44 years at the Chicago Sun-Times. But first, speaking of jobs, the latest figures are out from the Department of Labor. The U.S. economy added 175,000 jobs last month. That's the good news. The bad news is the unemployment rate rose to 7.6%. How does that math work? We're going to talk about that. Also, it's June. That means it's graduation season, and we'll find out what kind of jobs new graduates can find or can't find. I'm joined once again by Marilyn Giwak. She's a senior business editor here at NPR, and also with us, The Wall Street Journal's Sudeep Reddy. Thank you both for being here.
Hi. Hi. Great to be with you.
First, Sudeep, let's do this math here. How do we add nearly 200,000 jobs and see the unemployment figures rise?
It's a curious issue, but this is actually a case where bad news is actually good news. The unemployment rate rose in the latest month because a lot more people came into the labor force. Over the course of the recovery, which is now about 4 years old since we came out of the recession, we've seen a lot of people dropping out of the labor force. They've been giving up hope. Those people don't count as unemployed once they leave the labor force. Now they're starting to see signs of economic recovery. They're coming back in. If that continues, you may actually see the unemployment rate go up a little bit more before it comes down. But overall, that's a good thing if you're adding jobs at the same time and if you see those payroll numbers increasing month over month.
Okay, so on the balance, is this jobs report, in your opinion, Sudeep, good or bad?
It is relatively good. We're still in a very slow recovery. It's about the pace of the recovery we've seen for the last 2 or 3 years. So that's still troubling that we haven't really taken off the way a lot of people hope we would. It's been a choppy recovery, lots of ups and downs, lots of volatility. But when you look across an entire year, we've been remarkably steady. And that's what's kind of hard to realize is to see a steady recovery despite all of the anxiety we've had over the last couple of years is kind of remarkable, and we'll look back at that and see that we continue to gain month over month.
So far, the Dow certainly likes the jobs report. Marilyn, what do you think? Do you agree with Sudeep that this is on balance a good report?
You know, when we think back how the year looked back in January, looking ahead, we know we had higher taxes. There was a deal cut in Congress in December, and that raised taxes on the wealthy. It also took away that payroll tax holiday that we were enjoying. So everybody saw a chunk of their paycheck disappear. And then, of course, there was the whole congressional battle over spending, where scores of billions of dollars have been cut from the budget. And a lot of people thought that process that we called sequestration would really squash the economy. So, you know, we came into this year with a whole lot of weights on our shoulders, and yet we still seem to be chugging along. So I guess you'd have to count that as not great, but pretty good.
Well, is it different depending on your age? I mean, we've heard for a long time that this recession has been particularly hard on young people, recent grads. Obviously, it's graduation season. You mentioned in a piece that you wrote for NPR.org that the unemployment rate for people under 25 is much higher than the general population. So how is that outlook now?
All of these things are sort of relative, but this year we're seeing a better job prospects than we have in the last 3 or 4 years. It's been a long, bad recession. It's been a slow recovery. So the survey showed that jobs are better, and especially for college graduates, the offers for pay for beginning workers are up about 5% overall. So that's pretty good. But still, we have a tremendous problem with youth unemployment. A lot of young people just can't get started in this economy. You know, it's sort of on either end of the age spectrum. If you're an older worker, it can be pretty tough to find a job. But if you're in that younger category, it's also tough unless you have the right skills. And I think that's really what we're seeing in this job market is that if you've picked the right careers, things that are like engineering, computers, health sciences, you're doing pretty well. But if you're just a generic young person sort of kicking around looking for some kind of work to get started, it's a lot tougher.
And we know, Sudeep, that this is, it's also uneven for those who are African-American or Latino who've been hit disproportionately hard. What sectors are hiring? Are there jobs like Marilyn is talking about that are good for people who are having trouble finding work?
There are some jobs that are good for people. If you're a college graduate, things are actually not that bad. College graduates, the unemployment rate is about 3.8% right now. If you don't have even a high school diploma, it's over 11%. So there's a huge disparity based on education, and that's making a big difference. People who don't have the highest education are obviously having the toughest time, and those folks who are finding jobs are finding them in parts of the service sector that might not be paying as well. Hospitality, restaurants, retail trade, temp workers. A lot of people obviously are very happy to have a job these days if they can get one, but these are not paths that are really going to take people up into the middle class very quickly, and that's one of our troubles throughout the recovery.
And I wanted to say something about that figure for college graduates. You may know a young person who has graduated from college and they're not very happy with their job, and you hear 3.8% unemployment. Gosh, shouldn't they just be grabbing up jobs? But a lot of what's happened with that is they're sort of underemployed. They have a college graduate degree,
but they're working,
you know, part-time, or maybe they're working in retail. They'd like to be a buyer flying off around the world and doing something exciting,
who
wouldn't want to do that? But the reality is they're standing there, you know, stocking shelves in a retail job. And that makes that low educational person in a tougher spot. That's why so hard for a person who is a high school dropout. Actually, you might be very good, a really good worker who would do a perfectly fine job in a retail store. But you can't get that job because you're competing with someone with a college degree.
And this shows us why these numbers are only numbers, and how we have to really look over several years to see how the kinds of jobs people are getting to make sure they're getting the right ones to fit their skills.
Always trying to make us take the – or economic reporters make us take the long view. That's Sudeep Reddy, covers economics for The Wall Street Journal, and Marilyn G. Wax is senior business editor with NPR. They both join me here in our D.C. studios. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Celeste.
Sometimes history gets revealed in small, nearly forgotten scraps. The Allied invasion of Normandy took place on this week in 1944. On the evening of June 5th, the largest armada in history began to churn through heavy swells in the English Channel, and pink-cheeked young paratroops prepared to board airplanes that would fly through heavy gales to drop them in the darkness on occupied France. The weather was so vicious, German generals were sure they could rule out any invasion, which convinced General Dwight Eisenhower, the supreme Allied commander, that he could no longer keep 160,000 soldiers, sailors, and flyers, American, British, and Canadian, bottled up in ships and bases. "I don't like it," he told his generals, "but we have to go." So Eisenhower paid his respects to U.S. and British paratroopers as they lined up to fly into battle that night. Their faces were smudged with ash, soot, and tea for camouflage. Their helmets sported twigs and leaves. It was kind of dress-up that seemed to remind Ike, as he was known, how young were the men he was sending against a raging sea and scalding fire. He told his driver, Kay Summersby, "I hope to God I'm right." And that night, in a drafty cottage under the roar of wind and planes, Eisenhower penciled a note on a small pad in his tight, precise hand that he would need to deliver if the invasion went wrong. "Our landings in the Cherbourg-Havre area have failed to gain a satisfactory foothold, and I have withdrawn the troops," he wrote. "My decision to attack at this time and place was based upon the best information available. The troops, the air, and the Navy did all that bravery and devotion to duty could do. If any blame or fault attaches to the attempt, it is mine alone." It's telling to see today where Eisenhower made changes in his note. He crossed out this particular operation to write, "My decision to attack," which is emphatic and personal. And he drew a long, strong line under mine alone. When you see those words and that thick line on the note today in the Eisenhower Library, you might feel some of the steel of a man who would so unflinchingly accept responsibility. Ike didn't try to camouflage failure in phrases like, "mistakes were made," "our projections were not met," or "I will say nothing pending investigation." He wrote, "Any blame or fault is mine alone." Dwight Eisenhower put the note into his wallet. The invasion succeeded, and although a lot of dying was ahead, his note never had to be used. But it revealed a character that was enduring. You're listening to NPR News.